Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. Today we have, I believe, a very informative and inspiring show for you, as I try to present every week. We're going to be talking about the complete victory of Cuba's literacy program and actually also what they're doing in Venezuela. Our guest today is Catherine Murphy. Catherine is a San Francisco-based filmmaker who has spent much of the last 10 years working in Latin America. She is founder and director of The Literacy Project, a multimedia documentary project on adult literacy in the Americas. As an independent producer, Murphy's work has largely focused on social documentaries. She has field-produced films like Saul Landau's Will the Real Terrorists Please Stand Up, which is a great film, Eugene Kors' From Ghost Town to Havana, served on the production crew of Gay Cuba, and subtitled Stealing America by Dorothy Fadiman, Jaime Kibben's A Greening of Cuba, and Out and Refuseniks by Sonia DeVries. She also served as an archival researcher for Suzanne Rostock's recent biography of Harry Belafonte, Sing Your Song. Murphy served as senior staff producer at the Telesur TV Washington Bureau in 2006 and has produced content for PBS, Telesur, Avila TV, Pacific Radio National, WBAI, and KPFA. While in Caracas in 2009, she founded Tres Musas Producciones, a collaborative production house of independent women working in film, music, and literature. So that's quite a biography. Stay tuned and we'll be right back with Catherine Murphy. Catherine Murphy, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here and be talking with you.
Well, as you know, what we're going to talk about is something that's very dear to my heart. But tell my listeners about the Literacy Project, please.
Okay, so we founded the Literacy Project about 10 years ago as a multimedia project to collect stories on adult literacy in the Americas. Uh-huh. And we decided to start by documenting some stories from Cuba, from the literacy campaign that happened in Cuba in 1961. Mm-hmm. And we decided to start with that for a few reasons. We've done selected stories from other parts of the Americas, but you know, as we headed into the story around Cuba, we did it both because it was, you know, over 50 years ago now. So we wanted to catch some of the elders who had participated, but also because it was the first time that we found that an entire nation sought to become fully literate or right. Sought to overcome illiteracy. And right. So that itself kind of grabbed us. And then, you know, yeah. And then we sort of started thinking we'd make a small film, you know, Cindy, about a group of women that some of us involved in the project had an opportunity to meet. I met some of them when I was in Cuba in the 90s. And it was just like unearthing this huge treasure. You know, the more stories we collected, even with the first 3-4 stories, it became evident that it was actually this huge undertaking, just right. The magnitude of the campaign. And so it felt, I came to sort of see it, I have come to see it as one of the peak moments in the social history of the Americas, certainly in the education history of the Americas. And so, you know, it really grew as a project.
Well, tell us some of those stories about the real amazing success of that project in Cuba and what some of the, because I do want to talk about some stories that I heard the last time I was in Venezuela. And so tell me about some specific stories and about the amazing success. Cuba is now the most literate country on this planet. And, you know, people are always, we know, people here in the U.S. are always demonizing Cuba and how horrible the revolution is and was and how horrible the Castros are, were, and are. But, you know, Cuba, healthcare, education, housing, you know, all of these things are human rights that they take seriously. And here in the U.S., we're sinking our literacy rates aren't raising, we're sinking. So tell us about that victory, because people need to hear that over and over and over again until it gets through their thick U.S. skulls. I don't want to say American skulls, because, you know, we're not the only country here that's America. So
that's right. North America is all of our this piece of the planet, North, mm-hmm. South America, Central America, the Caribbean also is part of the Americas. I was right. Going to say también, yeah. So, well, you know, it's interesting because some Cuba scholars have said, oh yeah, Cuba, you know, it's like the threat of a good example. Why do they not want us to go to Cuba? Why is there U.S. legislation that limits or prohibits us from going to Cuba?
Right.
Because there's a lot, you know, it's the threat of a good example. There's a lot that they don't want to see. Well, how is it possible that this little island 90 miles off our southern coast, you know, 90 miles from Key West, actually, with such a so far fewer resources than we have, has been right. able to give healthcare to everyone, or in this case, literacy and education to everyone. So, you know, we started coming at this as the documenting of the literacy campaign through personal stories. But, and I'd love to tell some as you're asking, but I think also just to put it a little bit, just some of the basic chronology. So they, in September of 1960, Cuba announced to the UN General Assembly that they would become fully literate in 1 year.
Uh-huh.
And that was sort of a seemingly impossible claim, mm-hmm. at the time. But they made an open call for volunteer teachers all throughout the island. 250,000 people volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
And they set out to teach 1 million people how to read and write, right. in a 1 year time span. Now, of those 250,000 volunteers, 100,000 of them were teenagers, were under 18 years old, uh-huh. mostly between 14 and 17 years of age. And those were the stories that we looked at collecting of some of the youngest teachers, and especially some of the youngest women teachers, some of the girls,
mm-hmm.
who at very young ages, you know, 12, 13, 14, left their homes, for sometimes up to a year, and went out into the mountains and valleys across the country and taught rural elders how to read and write. There were also urban teachers, because a lot of the urban shanty towns also had very high illiteracy. But those were kind of, it was a different experience. Those teachers often stayed living with their families and would just go teach classes in the daytime and come back. But for the young teachers who left their homes for up to a year and went into the mountains and some of these eastern rural eastern areas that had little or no schools, and also kind of rules in school, like you had to wear shoes. And right. because, you know, most like poor rural Caribbean families at the time, you know, if you have 10 kids, like they don't all have shoes, is most likely. So something as simple as not having shoes would bar a child from going to school. So because this was over 50 years ago, we had a hard time finding many students.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the people who took the classes, but we found tons of people who had taught and on the literacy campaign in 1961. And for all of them, for everyone we found, it was a profoundly transformative experience. I don't think they were expecting that many young people to want to go, or, right. you know, really want to go. And they needed to have both of their parents permission. If they had a living mother and father, the both parents needed to give their signed permission on a form for young people to go. And for the young girls, just convincing their parents to let them go was like, that battle started there.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because, you know, sort of the 50s norm of the way the family was structured, you know, young girls were very protected, very overprotected, and were really was really limited if they were allowed to leave their house. A number of the young women told me, you know, quote unquote, I was not allowed to leave my house before that. One of the women said she wasn't allowed to go to the corner store.
Mm-hmm.
So there's just this super overprotection of young women. And when they went out to join the literacy campaign, you know, they discovered, like, not only did they discover the joy of teaching and of service and of giving your life over to something larger than yourself, but they also discovered that they were, you know, strong, tough, smart, independent, brave, capable. And that totally changed the way that they saw the world and right. themselves.
Uh-huh. Well, this is one great thing about these projects and about going to countries like Cuba or Venezuela, you know, and those are really the only two countries that I have any experience with. But is that the sense of empowerment that these people have received from the projects to increase literacy. And, you know, here in the United States, we have compulsory education, but I don't know if we, I don't know if we take it, education, in air quotes, I don't know if we take it for granted, and we know, of course, that the establishment, it's not a high priority to, you know, raise educated, self-aware, empowered people. As a matter of fact, they want us to feel like we don't have any power. And so the education isn't comprehensive, well-rounded, or set to empower us. And so I know Hugo Chavez, and my listeners know how much I admired him and how, you know, absolutely wonderful I think he was, and how his inspiration keeps on going. Hugo Chavez said one of the first things he was going to, he told me this. I did an interview with him. My first priority was to educate the people, because I know that educated citizens are empowered and engaged citizens. Can you imagine somebody in our establishment or in political power in the United States? Well, they might say it, but they wouldn't mean it. And Hugo Chavez absolutely meant it. So when I was there in Venezuela, I met women who were in their 70s who just learned to read. And they had tears streaming down their eyes.
Yeah.
You know, they were like, I didn't know what I was missing.
Yeah.
You know, and now I like have a new life because I can read and I can write.
Yeah.
Did you go, have you been able to go to Venezuela at all?
Yes. And I went to some of those classes and what they call that you're talking about. They have a few different levels, but that the first step, they called it Mission Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And Mission Robinson was actually partly used a lot of the Cuban teaching methodology that grew out of that original campaign in 1961. And the Cubans and the Venezuelans worked a lot together on designing that adult literacy program. And then, what, you know, over a million people went through those classes in Venezuela of Mission Robinson. And then they had something else that was, the next step was called Mission Rivas. I guess they had Robinson 1, Robinson 2, and then they had Mission Rivas,
uh-huh.
which was like a GED degree. But when they were getting your, you know, when you get your GED degree in the Mission Rivas, you also get training in like cooperative economics, how to start a cooperative.
Right.
That really is like looking at this integral way of stimulating people's, yes, empowerment, like absolutely a sense of empowerment, and also a lot of practical tools toward that empowerment. And I think, you know, people that don't understand that about Venezuela just don't know what has been happening there in the last, you know, 15 years.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because these women not only learned to read and write for the first time, they also got false teeth if they needed them, you know, so even improved their confidence and their because their appearance was improved, but they're on the town council.
Yeah.
Right? So they're on their community council. And these women, and it was mostly women, actually got together and built a metro cable to go up to their neighborhoods, which are built on steep hills. And they used to have to walk up and down those steep hills every day. But, you know, they worked with the government to build that project. So it's like you said, it's not just being empowered through reading and writing, is being empowered through being an active participant in your community.
And I think a lot of the women, I mean, I have no idea what, you know, percentage it would be or something, but I also saw the classes I went to were mostly women that were, you know, teaching. Something like 2/3 of the illiterate adults around the world are women. And it was interesting. It's interesting that in Venezuela, most of the students were women. And I know that a lot of them had been domestic servants.
Right.
And that kind of one of the things that the community activists said to us was like, oh, yeah, part of the reason why the wealthy classes are so upset about all the changes that Chavez is making is that all of their maids now are going to literacy classes
mm-hmm.
and feeling empowered and feeling excited and feeling like they have more to hope for in life. Than being a domestic servant, and they're getting tools for how to start their own businesses and how to form cooperatives and, you know, that really starts to change the power relations in a society. And, you know, that's what so many of the former, you know, elite are so freaked out about.
Right. Well, the same thing that happened in Cuba back in the late 50s and early 60s, but the elite Cubans left with most of the wealth of the country. They just left and left the country destitute. So like you said, for what Cuba has done with the limited resources, it should be a model. You know, it shouldn't be demonized. It should be a model for us to be following. If you know, and one thing about Cuba is I was there one time for Human Rights Day. They really take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights seriously. We signed it, but we don't even give it lip service here in the United States.
Yes, and full education is part of the Universal Declaration. People don't even know that in the United States.
Yep, nope. And so, yeah, it's just really, I'm glad that you're on the show so we can dispel. The more we talk about it, I think, and dispel the myths about Cuba and Venezuela around these things that could inspire us. You know, it's just not like we're going and we're attacking the people who are attacking Cuba and Venezuela. We're actually just saying, you know, look at this as a reality. I was on an airplane once going to Cuba, as a matter of fact, and I was sitting next to a couple from Venezuela, and through my limited Spanish and their limited English, I found out that they had been in Salt Lake City shopping. So you know they were part of the elite. And so I showed them a picture. I had my computer. I showed them a picture of this was when Chavez, before he even got sick. I showed them a picture of Chavez and I together. And first of all, they couldn't believe it was me. They thought he was meeting with Princess Diana. I'm like, no, look at that's me. I know people have said we look similar, but look here, it's me. And she goes, ¿te gusta Chavez? And I was like, yeah, I like him a lot. You don't? And she goes, no, they didn't like him. But she said he's been very good for the poor.
But I think when you start to think about, you know, that what's good for the poor, like the quote unquote, the poor is good for everyone. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the change in perspective that so many of the upper classes have refused to take in Venezuela. And I mean, I know people in the middle and upper classes there that support the Bolivarian Revolution, that social transformations that are happening through the Bolivarian Revolution. I think it just depends on whether they identify with what they feel like they have to lose or if they identify with what they feel like the nation has to gain.
Right. Well, it was so inspiring during the coup attempt when the people were saying, I didn't vote for him, but how dare they try to remove a democratically elected president? You know, we take our constitution, and because they wrote it, we take our constitution and, you know, what's going on very seriously here in Venezuela. But let's get back to your project. Before we started to record, you said you've been traveling a lot with the film. Tell us about that.
So the Maestro film, which is what we took, so we did over 50 interviews, mostly with young men and young women and young men, but mostly with young women, with the youngest women teachers on the Cuban literacy campaign. And we picked 8 of those 50 interviews, and one beautiful family in the Eastern Mountains that we took a film crew, went on horseback or muleback, which is
wow.
Went up in the mountains trying to find folks who had actually taken the classes, and one of the rural families is in the film. So we edited this very, I think, just human story, right, with it. This to try to weave together these personal testimonies and tell the collective story of the literacy campaign. And we launched the film over 3 years ago now. And we've been on the road full time pretty much since then with the film, which is very exciting and wonderful and beautiful and unexpected. And I say we because one of the women in the film has joined me often traveling around the U.S. with the film and a little bit around the Caribbean and Latin America. We were just in Nicaragua a couple weeks ago, and I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute, because they had a huge literacy campaign in 1980 that's really worth studying as well. But I think it's just been amazing to travel around the U.S. with this story about a nation becoming fully literate and about teenagers being at the forefront of making it happen. And it's really a testament to what's possible. Uh-huh. I think it really broadens the conversation about what's possible in education and in everything, because it's such a metaphor uh-huh. just for what is possible when people work together and when the priority of the nation is, you know, when education is part of the priority of the nation. And when rather than putting all of your funds into a war economy, right. you know, this is an example of what could be a priority of a peace economy. And people really are kind of moved by it. And I think they wouldn't even believe it if it weren't, the testimonies uh-huh. weren't so evidently all, you know, personal. Like the women talk with so much immediacy and emotion.
Do you have groups sponsoring you, or do you just pick a city and go in there?
We've worked with a number of groups. There's the U.S. Women in Cuba Collaboration that is a national network, a U.S. national network of women activists and academics and artists and others who sponsored our first screenings, and they did some fundraising, and we mm-hmm. brought Norma Guillard, one of the women in the film. And we did about a 2-month tour, you know, north, south, east, west uh-huh. in the States. And that sort of got the ball rolling, and it's just been rolling ever since. So say if we go, you know, a lot of times we try to go anywhere that we're invited, like uh-huh. whether or not there's funding, you know. Right. But sometimes, like if we get invited to a university that brings us into town, we'll try to stay extra days and right. meet with community organizations, uh-huh. social justice organizations, peace organizations, women's organizations, etc., with grassroots folks that are either working on literacy and education or just working on social justice issues in general. And it's been pretty amazing also just the threads, because not only are people really moved and inspired by the story, you know, by what they did in Cuba in 1961, but they also tell us a lot of the same narrative about what's happening with education in the United States. Right. So, you know, parents, teachers, students complaining to us about, or, you know, being really communicating to us about, you know, privatization of education, massive school closures, especially in some cities like Chicago, which closed 50 schools last year.
Right.
Under Mayor Rahm Emanuel.
Right.
And this whole, you know, so you have the issues of Common Core and the teaching to the test, and that was, you know, that was sort of bad enough. But then now coming onto these massive school closures and this sort of pitting of, you know, public against charters,
right?
And using charters as a sort of wedge to try to dismantle. I mean, what I can conclude nothing else. But to see it as the attempt to dismantle the public education system in the United
Absolutely.
States.
Absolutely. I think that's the intention. That's why they're attacking public education, withdrawing the funding, and investing in all these for-profit charter schools. You know, you say you go to colleges and universities with this film. I was born in the late 50s, so I went through... You know, ever since I've been alive, anything I hear about Cuba is, of course, just demonization. Cuba's evil. Castro's evil. It's a terrible country. Everybody hates it there. Everybody who lives there hates it there. And actually, the first time I went, when I met you down in Guantanamo, I was a little anxious to go. Because
yeah.
really, I was a product of my conditioning. I was like, wow, what am I going to see there, you know?
And are they going to let me leave?
Yeah, I know. So I was a little nervous to go, but of course I was with a bunch of friends and colleagues and everything. But do you find that the young university students kind of have the same preconception of or misconception about Cuba as somebody my age does?
I think now it's more of an issue of having no information about Cuba. It's
yeah.
so visibilized.
Yes.
You know, some of the professors that we've met or talked to, professor-like colleagues, they say, you know, there's been such an attempt to kind of dehistoricize us that a lot of the younger generations
yes.
don't, you know, it's like Bay of Pigs just seems like ancient history,
mm-hmm.
you know, Vietnam seems like
mm-hmm.
ancient history. So I think more than, you know, It's like any, so previously maybe there's a lot of negative, really negative, I mean, there still is a lot of negative information about Cuba, but I would tend to say even more than misinformation is just like a blackout, just some invisibility, right? So in a way, like, that's tragic. Mm-hmm. And it's also, though, they're a little, they're not quite as, I don't know, maybe preconditioned, I want to say. Yeah. And a lot of young people here are also dealing with the whole issue of, like, their college. If they're in colleges, we go to high schools, too, and it's awesome. High schools are awesome. But, you know, if they're in college, they're often getting in debt.
Right.
And they, you know, so they are pretty open to seeing, you know, they have their own experiences around the issues that are facing us here in the United States in terms of education.
Right.
K through 12 education and also higher education. So, yes, I mean, I think people have very little information about Cuba. They have very little positive information about Cuba. They're interested in seeing this story about Cuba, both because of what it says about Cuba as a country and what's been happening there in the last 50 years, and also what it says about us.
Well, two is, of course, when the Soviet Union fell, we were told that socialism, you know, global socialism failed. But we have this example 90 miles away from us, like you said, where it went through what they call the special period and went through some great hardships that, you know, they're barely recovering from today. But, you know, it's actually, like you said, it's the threat of the good, a good example. You know, they don't want people to know that. And I agree with you. That's why they don't let us go there. I mean, why, after all these years, why would there still be a blockade? Why would there still be a travel ban? You know, they don't want the Americans, you know, North Americans, to go down there and find out really what a wonderful place it is. Well, and we're the only country. Our Canadian brothers and sisters go down there on vacation. That's their vacation place, you know?
Right.
So it's just, it is like super bizarre. And
so we're supposed to think about them as enemies, right?
And
then you get there. It's like, after you're there for 10 minutes, you go, wait a minute, these people don't feel like enemies and they're not treating me like an enemy. So I think it's really hard to keep that psychology around enemies alive when, you know, if they were to let U.S. citizens go freely back and forth to Cuba.
You know, and that's really most countries around the world, right? They,
yes.
United States are the most is the most poorly traveled citizenry, and so, you know, we think we have to keep thinking this myth that our way of life is the best.
Yeah,
you know, and if we go other places like the Scandinavian countries, you know, and places where people actually have some rights and are taken care of by their communities and societies, we might start thinking we might not have the best way of life. I just read, and this is off your project a little bit, but, well, it's off your project a lot, but I just read where Cuba has sent something like 450,000 doctors into the world.
Yes.
So they send doctors and teachers and engineers and other healthcare workers, and we send troops. And we're supposed to think our way of life is better. And do you tell the college students that they could go to the medical school in Cuba for free?
Yeah, sometimes I do. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sometimes I do. I mean, you know, there are very clear parallels between the healthcare system and the education system. You know, their investment in healthcare and education, or their prioritizing healthcare and education, both for themselves as a country, but also for their foreign policy. So, you know, there was a point where, in the middle of the special period, where Cuba actually had more doctors practicing around the world than there were World Health Organization doctors. So I think these kind of ideas are so important to talk about in the United States, where we think about, well, what could we be doing for the world other than sending troops and invading and, you know, engaging with the world through military domination? You know, there is another way to engage with the world. There's a liberatory way. There's a way of service and healing. And teachers and doctors is a wonderful way to do that, and Cuba certainly provides an example.
Well, and cataract surgeries, how many cataract surgeries has Cuba provided in Latin America?
So many. I mean, it's that whole mission, Misión Milagro, mission, the miracle mission. And I've lost count, but there are so many. I mean, there are airplane loads full of people that go to Cuba to have their vision restored.
And right. And they set up clinics in poor areas in Central and South America to have the people come to them to do those surgeries. It's laser surgery, not cataract surgery, right?
I think, they do multiple different kind of eye processes that restore your vision. I think they sort of saw how could they kind of combine this very high technological level that they've achieved in medicine with massive investment in training medical professionals over the last, over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And with the needs, but also with some economic limitations, and help people around the developing world, and mostly Latin America, but all over the developing world. So my computer's doing something funny. I'm just going to keep talking.
Well, Cuba's also a small country, and so they're overeducated. There's not a lot for the people to do actually in the country. So, it's just a wonderful way to utilize their skills and their education and their healthcare by helping other countries. And I want to tell my listeners that they do accept in their medical school, they do accept people from the United States. And the only condition is that they work in a poor community, was it like 6 or 8 years or something? And the last several times I've been to Cuba, I've met with doctors the students from the United States. And it's just so wonderful to know that we have revolutionary young people that are in Cuba training to come back to the United States to help their community and be inspirations and leaderships for the communities. It's exactly what we need.
Yes, I think there are over 100 U.S. graduates from the Cuban Medical School at this point. That project is called ELAM. It's the Latin American School of Medicine. Yes. And one of the first graduates is practicing at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx. There are others around the country. Mm-hmm. And Pastors for Peace in New York City has more information on that, as does MEDIC, which has its MEDICC, and they have offices on both coasts, I guess Atlanta and Oakland, and are looking at both Pastors for Peace and MEDIC and many other community organizations around the country. Including the Birthing Project with Catherine Hall Trujillo, or looking at how to get those graduates, how to support them in their communities. And they're involved in some really interesting sort of integral health, community health work around the country. So I think we'll be hearing a lot from them over the coming years about why are people really sick in the United States?
Right. Well, yeah, it just sounds like everything coming from your project and coming out of Cuba is just very desperately evil.
Is that danger. Can I just give a shout out to the teachers, to any teachers that might be listening, especially high school teachers or any teachers, and we'd love to connect with teachers. We're really looking at finding long-term ways to keep these messages alive in schools and with young people in the United States today, so they don't feel disempowered, they feel empowered and see that they can change history and change the world and make a positive impact on the world around them. We're working together with the Zen Education Project, and are really super happy and to be part of their curriculum resources now. Uh-huh. So we're looking at ways to get, obviously everything free of charge. And we have a U.S. distributor for the film, which is Women Make Movies, but we're looking at developing some curriculum materials for teachers to help give them other, stuff to work with the film in the classroom. So if there are any educators out there that are interested in this story, we'd love to hear from them and help support them in any way and making that possible.
And in our newsletter, we will put your links and things like that. So, but go ahead and tell us your website and how people can get more information.
Okay, so the website is maestrathefilm.org. So that's www.maestrathefilm.org. And we also have a page on the Zen Education Project, resources for educators. And our distributor is called Women Make Movies. And they're in New York. They're a nonprofit. They were one of the first organizations in the world to distribute films by and about women. So, and their website is WMM.com.
Oh, great. So, Catherine Murphy, thank you so much for being on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox today. And thanks for reaching out to me because this has really been an interesting and really, it's been an enjoyable conversation for me.
Likewise, Cindy. Thank you so much. It's great to talk with you.
Awesome.
And your people.
the listeners. Okay. Thanks
to the listeners. Bye.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. Likewise.
Well, that's the soapbox for today. I hope you found the information as inspiring and informative as I did. And please go to the Soapbox People's Network, CindySheehanSoapbox.com, and check out all the links of what Catherine is working on and the trailer for her movie, Maestras. So as always, I'd like to thank Don DeBar, my engineer, my production assistant, Dee Dee Miller, my occasional helper, Mikey, and Catherine Murphy for her work and being on the show. And as always, you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.